to The Wonky Show. The government is trying to reduce stigma and increase support for students who are lonely. We'll assess the plans. Gillian Keegan is urging VCs to just stop oil. The LLE becomes law and HESA's making measures on meaningful work more meaningful. But what does it all mean? It's all coming up.
Departmental approach from the government, which almost had commissioned the poll with the headline that it wanted it to produce on the press release, predefined.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Associate Editor Jim Dickinson, and joining me to sort our rubbish into seven separate bins, as usual, three fabulous guests. In Gravesend, Selina Bolingbroke is Principal at the Building Crafts College. Selina, your highlight of the week, please.
Jim, we took part in Open House London weekend last weekend at the Building Crafts College, which was the first time we'd done so, and I was delighted to welcome 15 visitors, which was actually exceeded my expectations, and not all of them had got lost on the way to the West Ham game, so that was fantastic.
And in Biggles way, Jonathan Woodhead is policy advisor at Birkbeck University of London. Jonathan, your highlight of the week, please.
Thank you. Well, this past week we've had a very interesting lecture at Birkbeck from Ken Alisa, who is the Lord Lieutenant of Greater London, which was quite an unusual speaker, and he was talking around social mobility and lifelong learning, so I had an almost packed house for that one. So yeah, it was very interesting to hear what you had to say.
Great stuff. And in Morecambe, Michael Salmon is news editor at Wonky. Michael, your highlight of the week, please.
It was my son's birthday this week, so we had a lovely day. Started with a trip to the dentist and ended with vomiting on the kitchen table. But it was actually really nice, those two bookends aside.
Extraordinary. So yes, we start this week with loneliness. Freshers' weeks are underway across the country and DCMS is winging it, Jonathan.
Yeah, thank you, Jim. It was a very, I guess, a slightly left field piece of work from DCMS, although I realise they do have responsibility for loneliness, if that is a rather unusual portfolio. And there was some research commissioned by DCMS from YouGov around student loneliness, and it was saying that 43% of 18 to 34 year olds would be judged if they were, you know, if they felt lonely, which I thought was a rather sad indictment of things. I mean, it did go on the report to look at a 10-point plan, many of which I think seemed obvious to people, but it's always worth reiterating these things. But it's also about the things it didn't say. I mean, where do postgraduate students fit within that? Where do international students fit within that? And more importantly, where do commuter students also fit within that as well? And that was a little bit missing, I felt, from some of the information that came out. But it was, I guess, it's a useful part of the debate. I mean, the one thing that struck me from it was that at least 60% of students would strike up a conversation if they felt lonely. So it wasn't all doom and gloom. And clearly, this is part of a broader set of work that I think the government are doing around mental health and better health all around. I did think the partnership with Wingstop was rather curious. I think they've only got about 20 branches around the UK, although curiously one of those is in Bloomsbury. So I guess next time I'm in, I'll try and pop in and see if information's on the screens to see if they're following through on what they said they would do. But you know, I guess this is further evidence of the world as it is, you know, post-COVID, and people sort of coming out of that increased isolation of that time and socialisation. So an interesting part of the debate, but you know, hopefully it will help some people, but I suspect it may not be enough.
Selina, there's a particular framing here, isn't there, which is essentially that this problem, to the extent to which it's a problem, is an individual problem for individuals to solve. But that might not be the full picture, mightn't it?
Yeah, I think that is problematic. And I think it is clear that this piece of work does frame it around individual responsibility. And some of the critics of the piece of the research have, you know, pushed forward on highlighting that. I think part of the... I think it's the curious nature of why this piece of research has been commissioned by the government and by DCMS in particular. Right now, this is not a DfE commission into students' mental health, but I think best you could say it is, you know, fiddling around the edges of what is a very serious issue in terms of the declining mental health of not just students but young people generally. And I think also to contextualize it as something that is just a post-pandemic issue would also be misguided. I think if you look at the serious research around this area, there are far bigger factors that have been at play, you know, certainly over the last five, if not the last 10 years, and two that I would push forward forward that have been highlighted in more serious research, one being the impact and influence of social media, and the second being the impact of essentially the cost of living and poverty. And I think if we think about it from a young person's perspective, particularly those who are trying to study, poverty and feeling like there is less money to enable those young people to fulfill their ambitions, whether it be, you know, the removal of EMA, you know, sort of 10 years ago, right through to the declining value of the maintenance grant in higher education right now, I would argue those are, well, it's not really me arguing, the serious research that is out there has found a much stronger link between those environmental conditions and young people's mental health rather than precious weak loneliness.
Michael, we shouldn't moan too much, should we? Because, you know, not just this week I was banging on about the fact that it only ever seems to be DfE that worries about students. This is a good thing, isn't it?
It's sort of something that's neither here nor there. It felt like to me, it came out on Monday morning, it was in the Telegraph and the Guardian, and, you know, the government's doing a little thing around Freshers Week just to sort of raise attention, also get a bit of evidence through their polling. When the actual gov.uk press release came out, I actually found it quite infuriating. The title of it was "Lonely seems to be the hardest word for students to say," which, you know, slightly jokey press release title. And, you know, and also really trying to say very clearly, as Selina sort of alluded to, that, you know, the issue is we need to get students talking more about the loneliness. You know, but that's not, you know, that came out of the polling. So, you know, what do we have? 43% of the students polled agreed that they'd worry about being judged if they admitted feeling lonely, you know, but there was lots of other things. You know, almost 40% of students said they felt isolated from their peers. 24% said they'd felt lonely often or always in the previous year. You know, so there were lots and lots of other issues there that weren't just about, you know, students just need to talk about loneliness and that will help them. You know, there's all these issues around the cost of living, the lack of contact time, the lack of space on campus, the poor quality accommodation that we know students are in. So, you know, there is that thing about, oh, it's nice another government department thought about students for a minute, but we could also say it as still that issue around all the different silos of government. You know, who's responsible for housing, who's responsible for education quality, who's responsible for sort of immigration and visa rules, and then someone else completely different is responsible for whether they feel lonely or not. It's not joined up government in any way.
Jonathan, one of the things I've been doing over the past couple of years is actually tracking the DCMS loneliness strategy. And, you know, to be fair to it, there's actually quite a bit that's going on with other groups that they've identified. So, for example, you know, senior citizens has been a kind of big focus with quite a lot of money, community groups funded and so on. Whereas every time until now, DCMS has said anything about students, it's effectively, you know, you can read the email that's been sent by a desperate official in DfE to kind of bulk out, you know, whatever it is, the kind of overall report. Is there a case, do you think, for a kind of cross-government strategy here, and what could that look like?
Yeah, it could well be. I mean, there have been different, as you say, there have been different interventions already, but it's, I guess the challenges perhaps are different for different age groups as well and different types of people. So it's whether you can sort of you know, appropriately resource and support that. I mean, older people have different challenges from younger people as well, won't they? So yeah, I think they may well be, but you probably would need to have some quite high quality research to find out where that might be.
Selina, one of the things that does strike me is we obviously have, I mean, as you know, you've referenced some of it, really quite rich research into, you know, why students might be lonely, what can improve their belonging and so on. But actually, you know, apart from this little bit of kind of, you know, press release polling, we haven't really seen any response from government on that, have we?
No. And I suspect that is because the issues that serious research points to are not issues that the government, whichever department you might point the finger at, has actually got any significant sort of welly or commitment to changing the environment, whether it be about housing, transport costs, access to mental health services and indeed other health services, as well as the state of the higher education system, not, you know, in terms of, as I've said, declining value of the maintenance grant, but just think about the experience that students have had over the last few years. They're all issues that need to be solved, not even at the level of the university, but they are systemic issues and they are wider than higher education. And I think, you know, this to me is an example of, you know, departmental approach from the government, which almost had commissioned the poll with the headline that it wanted it to produce on the press release predefined.
There is, Michael, there is stuff that universities can do here, isn't there? I mean, I was with a group of SAMs last week in a student union, and there were four of them, and two of them said in their first couple of weeks they'd worked on a kind of group project together and got to know all sorts of people, and two of them said, well, they were kind of plunged into 500 people in a room lectures and never really got to know anyone until January. So I mean, there are things that universities can do, aren't there?
Yeah, completely. You know, one of the things that stood out, despite this slightly odd thing about the, you know, the partnership or the joint campaign with this restaurant chain Wingstop, which I've never heard of actually, you know, but
you,
I think actually, yeah, clearly but there is something really there about food and about meals and about sort of communal spaces for eating, which I think is a really good, is actually, you know, they've hit on something quite important there, and where I think we already know lots of universities are doing really good things here. And the flip side, as you mentioned, and from our, many of our sort of, you know, those of us who are external to HE but are often on university campuses, you know, the struggle to find places to sit and relax and to have dinner with friends and, you know, to sit down and have a sandwich with someone on your course between lectures, that is a struggle. You know, that was one of the items that stood out to me as, yeah, they're onto something there in a very slight and, you know, nascent way, and it would be really interesting to see, you know, sustained set of policy interventions from the government but also from institutions and institutions in partnership with their student unions to really do some, continue to, and to do all the good work that's going on about food, meals, space and getting students eating together.
And then just before we come off this, Jonathan, obviously one of the issues here is the framing around kind of 18-year-old partying undergraduates. Now, you know, sometimes people say to me that mature or part-time students don't want friends, they want qualifications, but this is nonsense, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think particularly from the London perspective, what we're seeing is that more, you know, more students are staying at home because of the cost of living crisis, but they still want a, you know, traditional, in inverted commas, university experience, and they do want, you know, student union and places to meet and places to you know, socialise and things. So yeah, I think it is a challenge. I mean, maybe mature students in some cases have other commitments, so that's different, but certainly those commuter type students and those studying part time will certainly deserve and deserve, you know, having that extra space. I mean, in one of our newer buildings at Birkbeck, we even created a space with, you know, microwaves and this, that and the other, so where students can come in if they want to have food and have, you know, have space where they can meet with people in their course or otherwise. So hopefully by creating those particular spaces, you hope that students are able to sort of socialise a bit more. I mean, I know the particularly the international team and others and access team do quite well at the start of the year to try and organise events and put things together because of a kind of slightly disparate nature of some of the home students. So that's perhaps less of an individual issue, more from where community solution perhaps. But I think as Selena mentioned in the earlier piece, there's only ever so much an institution can do. I mean, we would always do what we can, but, you know, then do you need to be, you know, more, I guess, national or perhaps structural solutions to some of these things around maintenance support and you know, housing, etc. as well.
Well, great. Lots of interesting stuff, actually more interesting stuff on the site about all of this. We'll put some links in the show notes. For now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
I'm Simon Meacher, Head of the Executive and Governance Office at Newcastle University. I've written for Wonky this week about the Magna Carta Universitatum, the unifying statement of core values of universities, that is to say, academic freedom, institutional autonomy and responsibility towards society. The Magna Carta applies to higher education across the globe, enshrining the interconnected nature of the challenges that universities are facing. Thanks to its universal appeal, the Charter now has well over 900 signatories. The Magna Carta Observatory, as custodians of the Charter, monitor the status of academic freedom and institutional autonomy. In the last few years, this has led it to mount a public defence of these values when member institutions face challenging circumstances. In these turbulent times, when the need for universities to demonstrate their purpose appears ever greater, the Magna Charta transcends boundaries and offers a compelling affirmation of the shared bonds between higher education institutions.
Now, late last week, VCs across the country got a letter from Gillian Keegan, no less. Michael, what did she have to say?
Yeah, this is an interesting one. So there were reports in the press sort of, like you say, at the end of the last week in the Saturday papers, that the campaign group Just Stop Oil is planning to, as the press put it, significantly escalate activity on university campuses over the autumn. There were leaked emails from the group, which supposedly sort of divulging plans that to recruit at least 500 university students. There'll be a huge new wave of protests. Spraying universities with fire extinguishers was mentioned, pouring fake oil, and then followed by mass participation, like slow marches near campuses later on in the semester. This is what's been sort of leaked to the press, if true. And sort of straight off the back of that, Gillian Keegan sprang into action and wrote to university vice chancellors with a letter that was quite a lot of it was sort of just saying what all the good work the government's doing on net zero, which is funny seeing as what happened a couple of days later. But, you know, she's basically, it was quite a sort of mild letter in the sense that it didn't have any particular directions. It was just sort of encouraging university leadership to, you know, make sure students are aware of the consequences of, you know, taking part in criminal activity, being prepared, you know, and ensuring that universities were thinking about it, which I'm sure they already are.
I'm just sort of thinking it must have been about a year ago when there was certainly speculation and there was commentary and calls from some Tory MPs to make Just Stop Oil a proscribed group, so on a par with terrorist organisations. I don't believe that that has been taken forward, to my knowledge anyway. But, I mean, what strikes me is what can universities do about this? You know, I am sure that there will be stalls at freshers' fairs recruiting members for Just Stop Oil and Extinction Rebellion. And, you know, there's nothing a university can or indeed might want to do about that. Many universities are extremely committed to awareness and actions that will impact on, you know, public awareness and government action on climate change. I mean, given where we are this week with the Prime Minister's latest announcement, which somewhat rolls back, I think this is a case of, you know, universities as well as students being, you know, quite some way removed from where the current government is in its thinking about the commitment to the climate. You know, this is literally young people's futures. And I think that certainly the Just Stop Oil campaign is perhaps underestimating. If it's been saying that they want to recruit 500 university students, I suspect there'll be far more than that. What can universities do to prepare beyond what they might ordinarily do in terms of the liaison with local police around potential issues of disruption? I think if I was sitting in a vice chancellor's office, I really would sort of be sort of thinking, we don't sit on our hands, but I'm not sure what action can be taken in advance around this. So you question, why has the letter been sent? And I think the letter has been sent. It's about positioning. It's about symbolism. It's about, you know, tokenism.
Jonathan, one of the things that obviously Gillian Keegan didn't mention was the Freedom of Speech Higher Education Act. Sorry, the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act. Does that matter?
Oh, that's an interesting thought, actually. Yeah, I mean, it's, I guess there's the issue of, I guess, freedom of speech, people, you know, saying and doing what they, you know, what they feel is right. But there's also, you know, it's as ever, where does the line get drawn in terms of disruption or, you know, potentially civil disobedience or whatever? So I think it's, you know, if Just Stop Oil or Extinction Rebellion want to recruit people at Freshers' Fair, you know, then that's kind of on them. But I think it obviously does draw a line when you've got, you know, a disruption and so on to other people. So maybe that's why it was left out. I don't know whether any lawyers saw the letter that went out, but as you say, it's possibly aimed more at the audience of newspapers and you know, political journalists rather than maybe vice chancellors themselves, really. It kind of has slight echoes of the Robert Jenrick IHRA letter, actually, that came out about sort of 18 months ago, you know, of what would, you know, what would happen, although that possibly is even worse in terms of the name and shame side of things. But yeah, I mean, if Gillian felt it was appropriate to send a letter, that's entirely up to her. But I suspect, as you say, the audience was quite different.
I mean, more broadly, Michael, now that the environment and climate change, certainly this week, has become what I think the commentators would call a wedge issue. This is, of course, also one of those wedge issues where generally universities and certainly students are on the other side of the government. And that will make for an interesting 12 months, won't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the effect of the government writing a letter to university management saying, can you make the case for us to students, you know, sort of hinting that. I mean, basically, I think there'll be a lot in university management thinking, okay, how do we make clear to our student body that we are taking all these different steps on sustainability? And, you know, go protest somewhere else, you know, go into central London and stop the traffic there, unless you're a university in central London. Sorry, Jonathan.
But, that's kind of what I was getting at. Never mind. You
know, central, Mallet Street.
Exactly. Next door to my office, but never mind.
but you know, there'll be universities will be worried about action taking place on their campus, as opposed to wanting to discourage students from getting involved in these groups necessarily. You know, circling back to this free speech issue, which I think is really interesting, this is going to become a big wedge issue. How it's going to relate with to things like the Freedom of Speech Act, and, you know, even Prevent, we've seen has been talked about in terms of climate extremism. But, you know, we've seen over the summer that groups like the Free Speech Union, who were very influential in getting the Freedom of Speech but onto the legislation, you know, they are pivoting towards stuff around climate change. You know, they had
critiquing
more in the
climate education work, aren't they?
Yeah, more in the world of work, right? Look, they were looking particularly at, you know, which is relevant for many universities, that they were looking at sort of climate accreditations or sort of carbon accreditations that people can get as a condition of progression, how these sort of environmental actions can form part of performance reviews, and how basically this goes against equality legislation and goes against people's, you know, right to disagree with the existence of climate change. And you know, at some point this is going to come into sort of things around teaching students and assessing students based on, you know, climate literacy. We're going to see all these things brought to bear, you know, partly just from as it kind of percolates in the popular imagination, but also as the freedom of speech legislation starts getting implemented. We've already got lots of people sort of hovering on the edges waiting to tell universities what they think it means.
Selina, across your career you've been no stranger to student protest, often disruptive student protest. It's a rite of passage, isn't it? Or is it?
I think if you look back, history would suggest that certainly for higher education students, it's a rite of passage. Not all students. I think, you know, FE College, it felt a very different environment. But I thought what was quite interesting, I don't know if anybody caught the Chris Packham documentary that was on Wednesday night this week, but actually some of the people that he interviewed who, I mean, the sort of premise of the documentary was about, is it time to break the law? Have things got so bad? And peaceful protest, you know, impact does it have? But one of the people that he was interviewing was saying every social movement has required some form of highly disruptive, radical, and sometimes violent change. So I think it's interesting times socially to be debating how can people, not just young people, because I think that's something about the climate change movement that perhaps is different to other protest movements, is that this spans generations. But how do you make an impact on not just public perception, but government action in a world where people feel increasingly powerless within our Western democracies? So yes, a rite of passage to some extent, but a rite of passage that if we follow the means of protest, demonstrations, meetings, letter writing that we've had in the past, I think people are much more cynical about those being something that really make a difference and really work.
I think the only thing I would say, Jim, is that you said that the, you know, universities and students are on one side and the government's on the other, but it's not entirely clear where the public sit on all of this as well. I mean, you've seen the backlash against the ULEZ recently, and there's various other things. And I think universities as a body, as a being, also get their legitimacy from the public as well. And I think there's an interesting dimension to that as well, is that, you know, if the public as you know, as a body, feel like sending their young people to university, or even, you know, as mature students, whether it still holds true. I mean, I think that the public do understand and accept the issues around climate change, but, you know, you can debate on the margins about pace and all the rest of it, but it's whether the broader public would subscribe to those, or, you know, have some belief in those actions. And that's what I'm unclear about, because, you know, you see one survey says one thing, one survey says another. But I think we also need to be aware of, you know, public legitimacy for some of this sort of stuff.
Well, interesting. It'd be interesting to see how this plays out. Now, every week on the show, we look back at how things were and how things came to be. With academic registrar and sector historian Mike Ratcliffe, here's the hidden history of HE.
So at the end of the Second World War, a post-war organisation of the further education, not defined as further education, but things that aren't universities, took place. And a lot of it focused on the proportion of advanced work that the colleges were doing. This included a lot of work for preparing students for London degrees, and an organisation was set out that put colleges into three groups: regional, area, and local. So the Percy report sets all of this out, but there's still a need to develop a new technological qualification. So they say they hadn't been able to reach an agreement on what to do, but there was an issue about whether or not this was equivalent to a university first degree. The government acts and creates a council under Lord Hives, which is called the National Council for Technological Awards. And it develops a new kind of qualification that could be accessible to these colleges. It's a diploma of technology. The idea is it's going to be equivalent of a degree. It's going to have the same standing, but it's going to have key features which are going to be applicable to all of them. It's going to have a four-year full-time setup. It's going to include a sandwich course. It's going to be very close to industry in how it develops. But also, excitingly, because technologists are a different kind of people, the idea is that they're going to form a different role in society. It has a very strong liberal studies theme to it. And so, in a diploma of technology, you will find a strong element of kind of liberal arts teaching. So, for example, there's a college that continue, you know, students can opt for a series of courses alongside their technological things on the Russian Revolution, on the art of the Renaissance. And there's a module called Cleopatra's Nose, which is the philosophy of history. You can also do conversational French. You can do the literature of the Jazz Age. There's an opportunity for students to take lots of different things alongside their technical qualification. The places that really focus on this are what becomes designated at the top end of this, the Colleges of Advanced Technology. They develop more of this work. There's a network of them around the country. Again, a planned attempt to create these things. So by the time we get to the Robbins report, what he finds is that you've got a network of technological institutions, but kind of stymied because they're doing this diploma of technology. And so he recommends that immediate steps are taken to grant chartered status to these places and to transfer the responsibility of finance from the Department for Education to the University Grants Committee. And then that these should become universities. So there's an upgrade of these places. Sometimes people mistakenly refer to the new universities of the 50s and 60s as Robbins Universities, but if anything has the right to be called the Robbins Universities, it's the Colleges of Advanced Technology that change. Robbins also notes the way that the council has worked in approving this diploma of technology in individual institutions has been important because they've attached great importance not only to the standard of the particular course that's being proposed, but to the general level and atmosphere of the work in the whole college. This system has worked well. So this is the way that they propose the new Council for National Academic Awards, the CNAA, will work. Yes, it will look at the individual courses, but it will also look at the general way in which the college is presenting itself and its ability to be a self-critical academic community. And so it's the CNAA twin system that takes forward and then develops all of the higher education provision outside the universities that we have up to 1992.
Now, next up, a new piece of legislation has hit the statute books. And Selina, there's been a rebrand.
There has. Feels like we've had this discussion a number of times, Jim, over the last 2 to 3 years, but the Lifelong Learning brackets Higher Education Fee Limits Bill received royal assent this week and has now passed on to the statute books. So green light, everybody is on the line ready to go. The Lifelong Learning Entitlement, which is what this legislation is designed to enable, is now going to be called Lifelong Learning Entitlement. And I don't want to know how much was spent on marketing consultants to come up with that snappy name change. But it is apparently a response after feedback from the sector. I hope that's not the only thing that has changed in the proposals, given the feedback from the sector, because I think most people that I know who would have responded and given feedback, that wouldn't have been one of the big ticket items. Now, just to kind of refresh for people who haven't followed this as avidly as myself and probably Jim, the LLE, good job that we've still got that acronym, Jim, because we would be confused, wouldn't we, is designed to cover essentially technical qualifications between level 4 and level 7. That was the original intent. You know, everybody moans that, you know, Britain is really bad at providing technical education. And this was the government's response to that. So the idea is that the technical qualifications that will eventually be delivered in short modules as well as courses, They will be funded, well, the courses would be funded from 2025, and kind of vague hope that modules could be introduced from 27-28. And people might remember that there was a pilot scheme in the sector last year, a funded pilot scheme, to look at essentially short courses that covered the areas of what the government defined as high demand technical qualifications.
Jonathan, I mean, behind this rebrand, there is a serious issue, isn't there? Which is, big questions about demand for the sorts of things that the LLE is supposed to enable. So, apart from, the grim prospect of the student loans company rebranding as the student learning company, is it the case that a student that's worried about debt, potential kind of short course student, is going to, not realise that this involves debt, and then they'll eventually realise it's debt, and then aren't they just going to be angrier?
Well, I've thought about this the past few days myself, actually. And I mean, sometimes there is some benefit in terms of the initial, branding that wouldn't sort of put people off, and that they might, then take a second look. But yeah, I mean, fundamentally removing loan from the title of the life and learning title isn't still the same, still the same design, still the same product. So I'm not sure. I mean, there is obviously a broader point around debt aversion and particularly mature students around this, especially when career outcomes aren't clear. I mean, I think the postgraduate loans, for example, have shown that people are prepared to take student loans on if they think there's, reasonably clear career path or earnings path, whereas obviously with the LLE, in some ways, it may not be very clear. So, I mean, I think the lifelong learning entitlement, trips off the tongue a little bit better than the lifelong loan entitlement. It's less off-putting. But yeah, fundamentally, it's still going to be the same product. So, I mean, I think we'll just have to wait and see on that one. But it is, I think the demand is out there, and particularly in certain more urban areas, I think there's a big demand for short course learning, upskilling very quickly. But how that's going to play out across the country is going to be the real challenge.
Michael, obviously this is now on the statute book, and the implementation is well beyond when we might expect a general election. What do we think Labour might do with this?
Labour have certainly in broad terms always said they're in favour of it. They like the idea of doing something that sort of, is what employers want, and it's reskilling, and it's, they like the idea, they like the sort of broader tertiary unifying of FE and HE to some extent. I think they are going to get dumped on their plate the question of costs, because it is going to be expensive for institutions to start doing this. It's going to strain finances even more. I think at some point there's going to need to be some proper investment from government, just to get things off the ground, to make things happen. Could be doing more pilots, could be doing, sort of promotion, could be some level of institutional incentive. And that's not going to sit well with Labour if they come in and realise that they have to spend money on it. The other thing they've often talked about, and they've sort of been allied with voices in the HE sector here, is that they've sort of expressed quite a lot of scepticism that 30 credits is the correct minimum level for a course or bundle of courses. So they've lots of, Open University, Staffordshire, various institutions have made this case quite a lot, that actually employers don't want students to do a full module. They don't want their employees to do a full module, 12 weeks of quite a lot of study. They want something a little bit more micro, a little bit more like on the sort of 10 credits, 15 credit side. So Labour have already hinted
30 credits that's more intensive.
Yeah, it could be too. So I mean, there'll be lots of interesting flexible ways that institutions could try to address this, not particularly helped by the fact that maintenance will not be available for distance learners as it stands. But so Labour have hinted that they might look to go sort of more micro, but it's gonna fall to them, basically. That's the thing. There's an election coming almost certainly next year, and all of this stuff that DfE say they still need to do around, further secondary legislation, a technical consultation, another bit in the autumn, it's all going to fall right in general election year. So inevitably it's going to be delayed, and Labour are going to have to think what they're going to do about it.
Selina, as you say, we have had this conversation before, I think, but if 9250 isn't enough for a full-time student, even if you kind of chop that into modules or collections of modules, that also won't be enough given the sort of on costs of any student enrolling.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a number of issues here, which is, let me just roll back a little bit. So I think one of the things, if you had a list of problems with loan systems in education, you might sort of on a matter of principle start with at least certain levels of education should be free. If you really want to incentivize people and use particularly technical education to drive economic growth, that I think is still a valid argument, albeit not popular in any political party, it seems, these days. But I'm just going to put that to one side. There is a number of other recurring problems with loan systems. So you might take fraud, lots of examples there. Inefficiency. And actually, when we think about inefficiency, it's how well does a loan system serve the individual customer, learner, student? How well does it serve the education provider? And how well does it serve the government as funder and custodian of that loan system? And I think that inefficiency question looms large with this. And then the final thing I think around loan systems, particularly in England at the moment, how well do different loan systems join up? I work in the sector and I work across HE and FE, and I find myself getting confused at times about what would be the right learner journey to advise on in terms of somebody who didn't have family help, spousal help, and needed to rely on a loan system to get them through from tertiary through to higher education. I think it's making things much more complex. So I think in thinking about, you know, the sort of prospects of a new government and what they take on, I mean, I would always want somebody to look at the systems in place and to be bold enough to really take some big reforming actions, because just adding another loan system into this without looking at what is happening with advanced learner loans, the future prospects of SLC loans, advanced career loans, I just think this is making a bad system problem potentially worse. And I'm not convinced that the way that this has sort of, you know, we've yet to see some of the detail, the way in which this will be implemented will bring about the step change in take up of technical education that not just the government says it needs, but actually I think is clear to most serious commentators. The economy really needs, and it really needs it right now to be able to transition into new industries.
And finally this week, HESA is trying to better measure graduate outcomes. What's going on here, Michael?
Yeah, so we've had an update this week on the progress of HESA's quest to really try to get good data on what you might call the quality of employment, although, you know, they've given it the snappy name of the job design and nature of work measure, which is doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, but, you know, it is a very interesting thing. It's based on responses to three items in the graduate outcomes survey that students do sort of a year and a bit after graduating from their undergraduate courses. So it looks at these items of whether graduates think their current work is meaningful, whether it fits with their future plans, and whether they're using what they learnt during their studies in their current role. And it sort of combines them all together and makes them into a single measure so we can look at, you know, by, you know, what's this sort of work fulfillment measure like for different subject areas, for different salary levels, for different sort of demographics. And so there's some really interesting findings. For example, I think one of the ones that stood out to a lot of people was that fulfillment in one's role is not particularly well correlated with earnings. Once you get onto a sort of salary beyond about sort of the low £20,000, remember we're talking here about people shortly after graduation, you know, and so it found that in general, that wasn't a big indicator of how fulfilled people felt. You know, another thing that stood out was that there's ethnic disparities here, even once you control for, you know, all the other sort of characteristics like where you are, what kind of employment you're in and what you studied, that there are disparities with people from minority ethnic backgrounds reporting less fulfillment than graduates. So really interesting, and it's still being developed. Could be a very, very useful data point for the sector in the future.
Jonathan, do you think if HESA gets there on this, this will make a difference in that sort of public discourse around the value of HE?
I would hope so. I mean, I think my view on a lot of this on the data is that, you know, it should help make informed policy and should help him make informed decisions. But the danger is it can often then be used as a sort of as a weapon to beat people with sometimes, because it doesn't fit a particular viewpoint. So I think, I mean, I'm generally in favour of more data to, you know, to support these informed decisions. But it's, you know, it's how it's used, and, you know, will it create some sort of other rivalry or some sort of, you know, ranking or something? And that's always my main concern. But yeah, you would hope so. And I think the fulfillment in the workplace is what, you know, is what I think a lot of people are looking for from a, you know, sort of graduate, you know, sorry, undergraduate studies and then on graduation.
Yeah, welcome the attempt to measure value beyond earnings, definitely. I think the problem always, from a kind of social science point of view, with these studies, and you know, this study highlights both subject difference, so, you know, saying medicine and dentistry comes out top, creative arts and design bottom, is, and it's a bit like some of the student satisfaction surveys. I mean, I've sort of come from a creative discipline myself, and quite often you find that sort of people's approach, outlook, their kind of starting point affects how they self-report their feelings, which is what their feel, you know, fulfillment is about, differently to people who, again, you know, come from a sort of different base, a different culture. So I think it's good that this is there, but I think, like Jonathan said, I would be wary about sort of early application of these results in a way in which it should steer certainly what universities should provide. I mean, I think kind of my experience of coming from a creative discipline is people's starting points quite often can be disgruntlement and, you know, I suppose to sound a, you know, creativity is part of problematizing and finding a way out of that. So I just treat it with some caution. But I do think it's interesting, and I do think it is important that we see the value of education beyond earnings.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out how we can keep you and where you work ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the site and click subscriptions. So thanks very much to Selena, Jonathan, Mike, Michael, who makes the show happen. We'll be back next week, and until then, stay wonky.